Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, producer Matt here. I've been behind the scenes working on the media podcast since 2015. Thank you if you've been listening all that time, and if you're new, welcome aboard. But this is a special message for all the doers out there. The producers, researchers, APs, engineers, simply I want to tell you this. You need to try Riverside. Riverside is the remote recording platform for all your audio and visual needs. My company, Rethink Audio, has been using it not just on the media podcast, but for many others too, from Happy Place to the High Performance podcast. It has been extremely reliable since we switched to it last year. And on the very rare occasion there is an outage, internet or otherwise, the backup there is, in my opinion, just as good as the main recording on Zoom. So I'm delighted that Riverside are supporting the media podcast. Try it out for free today, and when you're ready, head to riverside.fm and use the code MEDIAPOD for $15 off any Riverside subscription. There's a link in the show notes. That's riverside.fm and the code MEDIAPOD for $15 off.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deacon. On the show today, the BBC lets two more leading broadcasters slip away to global. This time it's Emily Maitlis and John Sopel. So why does it keep happening and what's the strategy at LBC? Also on the programme, the editorial director of The Week Junior, that's the award-winning print magazine for kids that's currently topping the magazine charts, will be asking, how do you explain the invasion of Ukraine to an eight-year-old? And in the media quiz, we discover which media players are moving into uncharted waters. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. This week, we've seen body warmers replaced by flak jackets as war breaks out in Ukraine. We've also seen male online maestro Martin Clark step down after 13 years. Clark said it was an overnight success that took 13 years of blood, sweat, quite a lot of cigarettes and quite a lot of booze. And the media industry has been mourning the tragic loss of a music legend, the inspirational Jamal Edwards. We'll be exploring his impact and legacy a bit later on in the show. But joining me first, it's a first-time guest. It's a delight to have Jill Hine, director of TV at Enders Analysis, here to unpack the stories shaping our industry. Jill, welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Matt.
This week, Enders have reported that the social media app TikTok has hit 1 billion users in record speed. Should some of their competitors start to feel a bit worried?
I would suggest that they're in trouble. I mean, it's a phenomenal growth story for TikTok, 4 years after the global launch, to hit the 1 billion users, and that excludes India. But what TikTok has done, and done incredibly well sort of during the pandemic, it's really got that 18 to 24-year-old demographic pretty much sort of sewn up. And though TikTok doesn't describe itself as a social media platform, what it actually is doing is taking time away from people using social media. And we're seeing that actually the age group, the 18 to 24s, it's expanding and it's getting older and older. And so what we're going to see in this is it's sort of hollowed out Facebook quite significantly, or Meta. And actually, what we've always thought about in terms of digital advertising, it's Google and Facebook. But what we're going to see is going to be Google, Facebook, and also TikTok coming in there. TikTok's advertising revenues last year were about $4 billion, and we estimate it's going to be about $12 billion this year, so a significant upload. So what we're actually seeing is it's actually Meta that's going to be sort of more badly affected.
I mean, Meta had really sort of bet the farm on Instagram for younger audiences, hadn't they? Snapchat has always done pretty well on its own on the younger end. but Instagram was really hoping for that audience. Are people leaving Insta and spending all their time on TikTok?
I wouldn't say they're totally leaving Insta, but they're spending a lot less time. And if you actually look at sort of the growth of these platforms, what you can see is that TikTok amongst the younger age groups is the largest social media platform by quite a way. And actually, it's tended to get its audience from Snapchat, but also Insta is actually in decline as well. All the growth is coming through TikTok at the moment for the younger age groups.
And has the UK operation made a mark on the ad market yet? Are they starting to do well?
They're starting to do well, but what we're going to see is it ramp up in the next couple of years. So they will go in, and we think they've probably got just as much revenue as Snapchat last year. That's going to increase again this year. So they're starting to do well on the advertising as well. But it's one of these, like many of these social medias, it's getting the users first, monetization later.
And are you on TikTok yet? Are you doing any dance routines?
I have seen my kids do many of them, it must be said.
Also on the show, we've got the managing director of production company Goldwaller, Faraz Osman. Hi, Faraz.
Hey, Matt. How are you doing, mate?
I'm good. This week, we've seen the return of the BAFTA Children's and Young People Awards. Now, you're the chair. Have you given it a reboot?
Yeah, so we've been talking about this for a while. We haven't done the awards for a couple of years now. And we wanted to make sure that when we did come back post-pandemic and we came back with a real new renewed sense of what children's content is doing right now. And I think that the market has changed quite significantly, even in these few short years that we've had a rest of the awards, both with the launch of a number of different streaming platforms and also with the Young Audience Content Fund, which has funded a number of incredible shows that have been celebrated in other award ceremonies. And then also just, you know, the incredible work that children's content has done during the pandemic, and from everything from supporting homeschooling to making sure that young people don't go completely stir crazy being in lockdown. So I think I'm really excited about what this year is going to celebrate and what we're going to do. And it's going to be part of a wider festival that's going to be celebrating young people's content and also inspiring the next generation of creatives to come through. So we're really, really genuinely excited about what it will produce. And it also kind of coincides with the relaunch of 195 in Piccadilly, which is an incredible space. I don't know if any of your listeners have managed to visit it yet, but if you get an opportunity, then make sure you go over there with bells on, because it is a remarkable space that they've created there.
What have they done to it?
So it's had a complete refurbishment. They've literally raised the roof. It's just a very special place, and it kind of very much meets the standard that you would expect from a brand like BAFTA. It's just a really, really lovely venue, and is I think really meets the ambitions of what BAFTA are trying to do to celebrate content. And it's, you know, it's not just about London. They're doing incredible stuff across the country and in LA as well. But the flagship building is what this is all part of.
Great. Well, media podcast outing to 195 on the way.
Let's do it.
And on to the big stories this week. Global has secured a deal with John Sopel and Emily Maitlis. Jill, this is another significant sort of leak of BBC talent over to Leicester Square. What do you think of this signing?
Again, as you say, Matt, it's another high profile or two high profile people moving over from the BBC to Global. It's a reflection of two areas, I suppose. One, the growth of Global and LBC, but also what's happening overall at the BBC and news. Obviously, there's been a huge political pressure on the BBC for many years, which has resulted in a significant loss of funding. Also, presenters' salaries being publicly available. And of course, both Emily and John have their salaries published every year. But also what's happened since the arrival of Tim Davey as Director General is one of the first things he's talked about is about impartiality and impartiality of news presenters. There's obviously different definitions of impartiality, but there's a big issue between, I suppose, what is the line between news and commentary? And if you're a presenter, and these two are very, very highly skilled and experienced journalists, you know, they would want to do some sort of opinion as well. Emily Maitlis has obviously been in trouble last year with the Newsnight and Dominic Cummings, where she did that sort of monologue, which I think probably majority of the country actually agreed with. But she's then been under quite a lot of constraints. And we've seen this all through. So again, it's another example of people, of seasoned news journalists leaving the BBC to go somewhere where they can possibly have more input.
And from Global's perspective, I mean, these are going to be expensive talent. Obviously, they're not working full time at Leicester Square. There's other things that I'm sure that they'll be doing. But it's an expensive investment for Global. Is it really worth it, or is it a little bit of a vanity hire for them?
That's a very interesting perspective. I would imagine it's a bit of both, to be honest. You know, as Global have, LBC has been struggling around for many, many years, and actually since in the last 2 or 3 years since it's gone national, they've invested significantly in its product, and they toe the line very well in terms of the Broadcasting Act, in terms of being opinionated but actually sticking within the broadcast codes of impartiality, because it's spread throughout the day. It's a significant financial investment. I'm sure, because Emily and John will be doing their own podcast, they must have some skin in that as well, which I'm sure is helpful for those two, and probably lowers the cost for Global. You know, they'd be expecting a return on the podcast, but I think a vanity project is probably a good synopsis as well of this.
Do you think, because they obviously mentioned that they would do an LBC show as well, do you think they'll end up being, you know, weekday presenters? You know, is Nick Ferrari under threat, do you think, from them? Or do you think they'll kind of pop up at the weekend alongside their podcast?
Obviously, we're not privy to the plans there. I would imagine they're more likely to pop up at the weekend rather than doing 5 days a week, because actually, as you say, they are both very, very seasoned journalists. I can't really see them doing a 2 or 3 hour show every day.
So, Faraz, what do you think of Maitlis and Sopel going off to Global? What do you think they're going to be doing there?
It's a massive coup for Global. I'm not aware of anybody that saw it coming. And maybe when you saw Dino, the producer, leaving the BBC, we probably should have been a little bit more savvy in figuring out what the big play was. But I think it's a bit, you know, Americast is a decent podcast. I listen to it and I enjoy it. And I think it's good to have a British perspective of what's going on in the US. And I think it's helped by the fact that BBC tone of being impartial, that newscast and Brexitcast has had as well, has meant that you don't get this kind of one-sided sensationalist thing that you get from podcasts that I also listen to, like Pod Save America and, you know, more left-leaning stuff, and obviously all the way to the talk radio stuff that you get that is very right-leaning in America. So I think Americast has actually been quite an interesting project that has helped both the careers and profiles of both those presenters. And and I think that, you know, there's a lot of talk about John Sokol didn't get that Laura Kunzberg job, and that may be why he started kind of looking elsewhere. But I think that off the back of the Prince Andrew interview, Emily Maitlis leaving the BBC is a really, really big deal. And it's a big boon for Global. Whether or not they can have the same level of exposure and profile by not being on the BBC is left to be seen. But it definitely demonstrates that Global's ambitions are global, are massive. Global's got global ambitions. There you go.
I mean, Emily has had it pretty tough, hasn't she? You know, she's had amazing sort of success, editorial success, but she's had grief over her social media posts, maybe not like the best backing from the BBC over some of the things that she said that people have agreed with, probably. And editors have changed, and people she's worked with has changed. I mean, has she sort of slipped through their hands? Is that a problem for the BBC?
Well, I mean, this has been going on for a while, and obviously Andrew Neil was part of this and may well have been the first person to for the BBC to have lost. But, you know, there are personalities, and if you are a personality, you're going to want to have an opinion. And sometimes that can be quite soft, like what happened to Nagar Munjetti and the fact that she was, you know, had her finger wagged at her for saying what she said about Donald Trump. And sometimes it can be a little bit more controversial, like we had with Andrew Neil and Emily Maitlis. And I think that it's key. It's clear that you've got these anchors and hosts that clearly have an opinion, and there's a lot of things going on in the news right now. It's very difficult not to have an opinion. And the BBC are doing everything they can to remain impartial. And sometimes that's simply at odds with the level of personalities we're talking about here. And I think that's true for both Emily and John. So it's not a surprise that we're seeing a lot of people look towards the commercial sector, where the rules are a little bit more lackadaisical around impartiality, so they can kind of continue to craft their own voice that can sometimes be bigger than the editorial voice of the BBC itself.
Also, another hire that happened at the end of last year was Andrew Marr. They announced this week, this is Global, they announced this week that he's going to be on air 4 days a week from March the 7th, from 6pm to 7pm, chopping a little bit of time out of Eddie Mayer's show. They also mentioned that the show's going to be televised live on Global Player. And this is obviously quite a thing, this sort of combination of simulcasting radio and television. GB News launched nationally on digital radio just after Christmas. Are all these sorts of newsy, opinion-y channels sort of merging together, being both telly and radio? Are we going to see LBC on the EPG?
Well, then you've probably got to add in Talk TV, which is going to be the news UK's radio or TV plus, no doubt, radio in there as well. Are they all going to merge in a bit? In some respects, I think the answer to that will be yes. How much audience they all get is a different matter. The news environment will be very different than it has been over the last few years, but I'm sure the audience to many of these shows will be pretty small, because in reality, and LBC do this incredibly well, is they do the sort of the small snippets of, say, 3 or 4 minutes of each of presenter that they can then put out on YouTube and social media. That works. Watching for a whole 2 hours may not work. It could be a different proposition with it if it's Andrew Marr and he's got good people in, because again, he's a very, very excellent interviewer.
I mean, it seems a real battleground, doesn't it, with Talk TV, GB News, and even if LBC was to put their toe into this water too. And I mean, GB News' audience hasn't really set the world alight. Do you think there is growth in that market? Do you think they'll gradually teach UK consumers that it's there, or is it still going to be a tough sell?
I think GB News is going to be a tough sell. It has a certain type of audience, and you're limiting yourself to that audience that is, you know, very pro, you know, Nigel Farage, etc. So you're actually always limiting yourself to a small audience. And actually, if you watch it, it's a lot of monologues going on. It's, at the moment, it's not that great quality throughout most of it, which will have an impact. And of course, when they're trying to do their biggest audiences, they're up against not just news programmes, but they're actually up against general entertainment in the evening. And people still want to go and watch Coronation Street, EastEnders and everything else that's on at sort of 7:30 to 9 o'clock. So it's difficult to break through. It will be interesting when we see the Talk TV launch, because I think they will be probably less opinionated in one way than GB News, and therefore they may be able to generate better audiences or more significant audiences than GB News. But it's very difficult to break into this space when you're up against very experienced.
No, it is tough, and I think even with big stars, and obviously they've got Piers Morgan, who'll do a sort of hybrid entertainment news show. It's just tough to drive awareness, isn't it, and get people to tune in. Looking at some other news, this time further up the EPG at RT, what was Russia Today, with the military assault on Ukraine, UK ministers, including the Culture Secretary Nareen Dorries and Sir Keir Starmer, have called for RT to be reviewed or even shut down by Ofcom. Jill, what do you think is going to happen? Are we going to see RT removed from UK screens because the government want it off?
It's a very odd one, isn't it? I mean, we've got to balance the sort of the freedom of speech and peddling misinformation. At the moment, there is no reason for Russia Today to be taken off the screens. It has a broadcast licence. It's allowed to have a broadcast licence because the owner, even though it is state-funded, which is allowed under the sort of the 1990 Broadcast Act, is not supposedly funded by a political party. So it's allowed to have its licence. What they can bring it up for is actually if it does a breach of the licence in terms of its output and if it's deemed as being impartial, misleading, etc. Its audience is absolutely tiny at the moment. What was actually happening here is we're getting a huge amount of more airtime for Russia Today than it's ever had before in terms of what the government's been saying. And of course, we then got to have counter argument against that is actually what about what will happen to, if we do take Russia Today off, what will happen to BBC out there in the Ukraine and Russia? I've no doubt there'll be a tit for tat. And we've got to consider actually the downside of that with where you get Russian people and people in Ukraine not being able to listen to an impartial news broadcast of actually what is actually happening out in those regions.
I thought Ofcom's response was actually pretty good, where they said you know, if RT breach the rules, then we'll deal with it and we'll deal with it quickly. But arbitrarily taking it off isn't particularly the right thing to do.
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, if you're talking about Russia today and its output could be influenced by what's happening in the Kremlin, actually, what does that mean if our regulator is sort of forced by political pressure to take channels on or off? It's working in reverse. So I think, as you said, I think Ofcom's response is a very good response, and they will be looking at all the news coverage and seeing if it does actually, if it does breach the rules.
Faraz, if you were in charge of Ofcom, would you leave RT on or would you yank it off the air?
Well, that's a loaded question, Matt. You went straight in there. If I was in charge of Ofcom, I would have a very long to-do list right now. But I kind of broadly agree with Jill. I think that the approach that Ofcom are taking is the right one. I think that in particular, Jill's point about the BBC is really, really valid. And my view is that it's probably more of a threat to remove media services from Russia, like the BBC, than to have them removed from, have RT removed from the UK. So I think kind of watching it very closely and fast-tracking complaints seems to make a lot of sense, not least because I think it will put more scrutiny on any propaganda that does come through that channel. And I think that's probably, that level of scrutiny is probably a good thing. I can't imagine that the Russian government are particularly bothered about whether or not RT are on air in the UK or not at the moment. So I kind of agree with Jill that the approach that they're taking seems to be the sensible one.
The latest ABCs for the magazine industry have been released, and there's actually quite a bit of good news at the newsstand. I spoke to Anna Bassi, who's the editorial director at The Week Junior, to find out how a print magazine for kids has ended up in the top four news print publications in the UK.
I mean, we've had an astonishing journey, really, since launching in 2015 with pretty modest ambitions. I remember being quite excited when we had 20,000 subscribers, and now we have over 90,000 subscribers, and it shows no sign of slowing down, really. I mean, there literally wasn't anything like it before we launched The Week Junior. And I think prior to our launch, the idea of a news magazine for kids had been pretty roundly poo-pooed by most people who you would ask. Generally, the assumption is that children just want to read about, you know, fictional brands or you know, television programs, and that they wouldn't buy a magazine anyway unless there was something free stuck on the front cover. The Week Junior sort of was a refreshing change to all of that, and it's shown that you really can make a magazine that children want to read, that is about the real world, and it doesn't have to rely on a gimmick to sell. I think once people find it, you know, once parents find it and once they get it into the hands of their children, we've seen time and time again that even kids who don't really like reading very much or have struggled with reading have really engaged with it and have found something about it, which isn't obviously accidental, but you know, that there's always something in there for every child, and it's incredibly accessible. So, and then of course the last few years have been pretty busy with news as well, and that's sort of probably helped us.
So for listeners who haven't seen a copy, what's in The Week Junior magazine? What do kids get?
Everything. They get everything. We've described it in the past as a sort of a kaleidoscopic walk through the world over the past week. So, and that really is what it is. And it is, I mean, we're best known, I suppose, for being a current affairs magazine for children. And of course, the first six pages of every issue are devoted to news from around the world. But it isn't just that. It's about books, and it's about sport, and it's about science, and it's about the natural world and the environment, and it's about films and great photos and things to do and things to make. So there is literally something in there for every child to read, to enjoy. Something, you know, they'll discover things they didn't know they were interested in. You know, it really is a kind of a really good, bright and engaging and pretty positive summary of the world in a way.
Is it sort of split between sort of subscriptions or newsstand or schools? Where does the audience come from?
Very much subscription. I think I'd say we're probably about 90% subscriber, which is wonderful. And that is the area, of course, in which we've seen the most growth. So we have people who will be getting that magazine through the door every Friday. And I think there's something about that as well that's more special than picking up a magazine off the newsstand. This, you know, having something come through the letterbox with your name on it every Friday when you get back from school makes it something of an event as well.
How do you cover stories? So at the moment, obviously, we're waking up when we're recording this to Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. That's obviously a big issue. That's quite a knotty one to explain to 8 to 14 year olds. Where do you start with something like that?
you have to go right back to the beginning. I think that, you know, it's interesting because we sent this week's issue to press yesterday and we had many conversations about how much detail we were going to go into on the situation in Ukraine. And of course, at that point, the invasion hadn't officially begun. So we took a line where we referred to it, we spoke about sanctions, but we didn't unpack the story in any great depth. And that is something we're now going to have to do next week. And, you know, all we can do is go right back to the beginning. I think for children, you know, the word war is, you know, for all of us, it's absolutely terrifying, isn't it? And you know, these children whom we write for have just lived through 2 years of pandemic. They're already quite anxious about climate change. And so putting war on the table in front of them as well is quite a thing to have to do. So we'll just stick to our sort of tried and tested formula, which is, you know, remain calm, provide them with the facts, give them the context, you know, don't speculate. I think one of the things we learn, especially probably starting with Brexit and certainly through the pandemic, has been that we should never speculate. We shouldn't be talking about what might happen or what could happen unless we've got something really helpful and sensible to say. So that's what we'll do here. And I think once we've explained the background to the story, we've explained where it is, you know, who's involved and what people are saying about it on all sides, we'll try to find a positive in there somewhere. And there will be something. There will be somebody who's helping. There'll be a charity who's on the ground. There will be, you know, there will be stories we can tell of people in the community and their sort of resilience and creativity in adversity. So that's something we tend to try to do whenever there's a difficult story, is to try to end on a note that shows that there is a way forward and there are people who are doing the right things as well. I think the worst thing we could do would be to leave a child with a sort of a deep sense of anxiety and uncertainty. You know, inevitably there will be some, it's unavoidable, but I think we have a job to do, which is to show that the world isn't awful and that there are good people and good things that happen as well as all the bad things.
That was Anna Bassi. You can find out more at thewheatjunior.co.uk. And if you work in the media, you know that it's hard to get people to understand that they need to pay for the content they enjoy. And just like your TV show or radio programme, this podcast doesn't magically come together. And we do like to pay some of the people who do all the hard work putting it together. To help us do that, and if you can afford it, I'd encourage you to become a supporter by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/mediapod. I was looking at the podcast charts, and it turns out that the Cayman Islands, we do pretty well in the Cayman Islands. So if that's you listening to us from there, I think you should definitely join our Patreon, patreon.com/mediapod. Each week, our patrons get exclusive access to content as well. This week, they can find out more from Anna Bassi at The Week Junior. If you join up now, you can access that, plus all of our recent extra interviews too. Just head along patreon.com/mediapod. And we'll be back with more media news and, of course, our weekly quiz after this.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. Jill and Faraz are still with me, and it's time for some more media news. The media industry has been mourning the loss of the talented Jamal Edwards, founder of SBTV, who helped launch the careers of talents including Ed Sheeran and Stormzy. Faraz, what will Jamal's legacy be to British culture in years to come?
It's actually been quite a difficult week for lots of people who have been in Jamal's significant orbit. I think my timelines across social have just been flooded with not just good wishes, but photos and videos and so much different types of content where Jamal has appeared. And it's one of these things that has been really spiriting to see that he's touched so many lives across so many different spectrums from charity and outreach and obviously across music and entertainment as well. I think what I would say is the influence of music that Jamal's had is really obvious, and it's been the thing that a lot of people have been focusing on. But I think what's also compelling is his influence on production companies and media outlets run by people of colour. I think he has genuinely inspired a generation of not just people that are interested in music and entertainment, but also people that are interested in business and entrepreneurship. And in recent years, he's been doing some incredible work around his self-belief campaign and really encouraging particularly black men to be far more positive about what they can achieve and what they can do in the world around them. And at such a young age, to kind of achieve that many things is a real kind of testament to what can be done when you have that level of confidence. But I think more than anything else, you know, it's been a hard week. There's no doubt about it. I worked with Jamal very briefly. I worked with his team when I was at Channel 4, his early team at Channel 4. And they were all incredible and were all kind of renegades and, you know, really disruptive in a way that could have rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way. But I've yet to meet somebody that hasn't talked about Jamal's smile, hasn't talked about the way he approached things, hasn't talked about his positivity. And that early team have all gone on to do remarkable things across so many different sectors. So his ability to spot talent, not just in music, but in media as well, was unparalleled. And I think he'll be sorely missed because I think we were all really excited to see what he was going to do next. And this is a real shock to everyone that had the smallest association with him.
SBTV was one of the first sort of YouTube native kind of platforms, programs, was very of that media early on. I mean, really, it was a trailblazer for what a lot followed from there. People were very much inspired by what they achieved.
What was interesting about SBTV is it appeared at that time when YouTubers were really becoming a thing. So there were lots of individual accounts, you know, Zoella being the kind of most obvious one, Thatcher Joe and Dan and Phil. There were lots of kind of personality accounts as individuals. But what SB was doing was one of the very few channels in a more kind of traditional sense, in that it had a purpose around music and it was championing other voices. And that's where it started. It was also kind of around a time when Copper 90 first came about and we had things like FoodTube as well. So there was a real kind of backing that Jamal got for that platform by YouTube. He obviously had the Google Chrome advert that really celebrated the work that he was doing. And I think that he just saw it as a space to have an outlet for things that he was interested in. And a lot of people followed suit as a result of that. But I would say that his more recent work has been less around that platform and more around this idea of, like I said, entrepreneurship and what he can do for the wider community. The two things in combination is kind of where we are right now, which is this idea that you can have a platform, but also you can be a personality at the same time. And the two things aren't necessarily exclusive.
I mean, Jill, media companies have had a lot of trouble setting up kind of YouTube channels or, you know, TikTok locations where individuals have had a much better go at it. I mean, even now, I'm kind of sort of 15 years on into YouTube, it's still tough for media companies to really do it properly. Is there anyone out there who's doing it well?
That's a very difficult question. I'm not sure that many people out there are doing very well. I think the traditional broadcasters have got this issue, is that they're coming it from a broadcast way rather than actually thinking about it from the 100% opposite. And they're sort of tied with all the strictures and the codes they've had for many years. And it's a very, very different mindset. And broadcasters still, 15 years on, probably less than that, still haven't really got up there. They're trying to, but we're still seeing, you know, and they have to do this to appeal to a younger demographic that's actually moving away from television, as is well documented. But they haven't quite got the mindset out there in the right way at this moment in time.
I think also it's worth saying this kind of a whole idea of failing fast is, you know, although it seems like a bit of a cliche now, it's still very much true in this space. And what SV did alongside lots of different partners in that space is that, you know, we celebrate Jamal for all the successes around Stormzy and Ed Sheeran and Dave and Jessie J and Rita Ora. All of those things are absolutely true, that he was at the very beginning of all of those artists' career. But there were also a number of artists that he had on that platform that didn't take off, that he did champion, that didn't quite make it. And I think in a traditional broadcast space, there's a lot of anxiety and nervousness around that. But I think that what we're seeing from this generation that Jamal was part of is provide the platform, put people out there, put the content out there, and let the audience decide what success is. And that kind of bravery around just trying things and seeing if it will work, and then if it doesn't work, not having such a massive level of anxiety around it, is a real kind of key to why these channels succeed. And YouTube as a platform moves so quickly, which means that what worked 6 months ago, or even 3 months ago, won't necessarily work in 3 months' time. And it's very difficult for bigger companies and bigger broadcasters to get used to that idea, because they put together a plan, they try and enact that plan, and it may well not be suitable anymore. And I think that Jamal's ability and people of his generation's ability to pivot very quickly into new ideas and new ways of doing things, and not be too hung up if it doesn't quite work, is a real key to making this work.
Well, speaking of pivoting, it's time to move on to the glamorous world of the media quiz. This week it's entitled Uncharted Waters. So I'm going to give you three headlines where an individual or media organisation has headed into uncharted waters this week. You've just got to tell me who was making the leap. So there's three rounds. Buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So Faraz, you will say...
Faraz.
And Jill, you will say...
Jill.
Let's play Uncharted Waters. Right, number one. A social media platform that's ventured into audio.
A social media platform?
Jill.
Jill.
Well, that's got to be LinkedIn. Trying to sort of go down the audio route, and I would imagine we'll probably do it quite successfully, but all around about business ventures and how to succeed in various areas.
That's correct. LinkedIn, social media platform for professionals, is launching a podcast network for career-related content. Faraz, do you think LinkedIn are going to be the new serial?
I had a bit of deja vu then, because I was a bit like, I'm sure Facebook launched their audio strategy like 2 years ago, and I didn't realise that was still a story. I was like, maybe I'm so cutting edge in my media news that I'm like picking up stories that happened 2 years ago. But no, I didn't even realise that LinkedIn are jumping into the podcast space. I mean, I would say that it's Stephen Bartlett's Diary of a CEO and Jake Humphrey's High Performance Podcast demonstrates that like there is very much a crossover between business and podcast in a successful way. So it wouldn't surprise me if they were able to put together a platform that connected people in the way that LinkedIn connections spam your inbox.
Jill, Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces, they're quite kind of get rich quick or career minded or kind of personal development related. They haven't necessarily set the world on fire. Do you think actually jumping into podcasts is maybe a pretty good platform for LinkedIn?
I think something like Clubhouse is very different. At the start of, I suppose, during lockdown, it took off really well, and then it just sort of has dwindled away, really, hasn't it? I think LinkedIn has got something different to offer. It's got billions of users, I have absolutely no doubt. But it will never be huge, but it could be quite. It could be something that is helpful to many people. And I think also the fact that so many people are now working from home as well. You could imagine people having some of these podcasts on that people have mentioned. Oh, you've got to listen to this one. You can imagine that working, but it's pretty incidental to LinkedIn's business model.
You know, if you suddenly make a connection with somebody at LinkedIn, the ability to jump into a meeting with them, and you know that kind of thing where you message somebody on LinkedIn and say it would be great to start a meeting. It's not a direct way of doing that straight away, saying, you know, let me know what your diary is and I can press a button and chat to somebody that I've just made a connection with LinkedIn. Seems to be quite savvy. But I think with Microsoft want to push further into social media, this seems to be quite a smart play, because if you can kind of create that direct connection that's quicker than what is currently happening, which is you message somebody on LinkedIn and then move it over to email quite quickly, closing that loop could be quite a powerful thing for Microsoft to do.
I think LinkedIn are very, very much pushing into content, and you know, that feed being more than just, hey, I've got a new job, and people putting more information on there. So adding podcasting is kind of further going into that space. Right, question number two. There is a new fish in the broadcasting pool with more competition for covering the big political stories of the year. Who's that?
Oh, God, this is GB News, isn't it?
Faraz, you need to buzz in.
Faraz, GB News. I didn't want to say my name and GB News in the same sentence. That's why I was trying to avoid that. But they've added themselves to the. Well, no, they haven't added themselves, but they've been added to the broadcast pool that kind of allows them to get further access to stories from the heart of Westminster. I mean, my view is that this is the ongoing balance between whether or not GB News is a news channel, whether it's an entertainment channel, which I don't think they themselves have kind of quite settled on yet. But, you know, fair play to them. They're able to kind of get into the same room as the big players, and that's what they've always strived for. So let's see if they can not mess this bit up.
And finally, an infamous figure has returned to the world of social media, launching the Truth app. Who's that?
It's Trump, isn't it?
Faraz, if you're going to play the game, you have to play by the rules.
Sorry. Faraz. Truth Social is backed by Donald Trump's like nefarious fund that doesn't quite make sense, but is obviously a bit of a money spinner for him. Although I think launched is a bit of a strong word, because my understanding is that the waiting list of it is pretty long right now. So it's a bit of a wild roller coaster for them still. And I imagine that trying to get it launched in time for the midterms, whether or not they pull it off is another matter.
Truth Social, it's actually sort of backed by a kind of slightly strange financial mechanism. Who'd have thought that with Donald Trump? But they've raised quite a lot of money to do something potentially quite interesting. He's obviously got the fans to join in. Are we being a bit mean on Truth Social? Do you think it could have a chance of being a success?
Sadly, I think it could have a chance of being a success, just given the sheer numbers of people that seem to support Trump over there. And the name is just absolutely fabulous, isn't it? Truth Social. Couldn't be further from.
And you have, I think on there, you have truths or retruths are the tweets and retweets nomenclature.
I've heard a rumour that the terms of service of the app say that you can't criticise any of the investors or anybody involved in the development of the app, which basically means that if you want to be on the app, you're not allowed to say mean things about Donald Trump because you might hurt his feelings. I'm a little bit more pessimistic about it, as you could probably tell. You know, there's a lot of people in this space now with Getter and Parler and now this. And I think that it does live or die on how much engagement that Donald Trump has with it. And as we all know, that man is all about attention. And unless this has the masses looking at it, which I don't think it will, I imagine that he'll get quite bored of this quite quickly. In the same way that he got bored about selling stakes and university diplomas and whatever nonsense businesses he got involved in. It's a nice story, but I can't imagine we'll be talking about it in a year's time.
I sincerely hope we're not talking about it in a year's time, to be honest.
That's our show for today. My thanks to Jill Hind and Faraz Osman. Jill, where can people find the latest Enders updates?
Go straight to our website at endersanalysis.com, or obviously you can just drop any of us an email and we'll send something straight over.
And Faraz, if people can't find you on Truth Social, how can they keep up with you?
I mean, even if I wanted to set up an account, the waiting list is too long, but the waiting list to contact me isn't that long. So if you want to do so, Goldwaller is gold_Waller across all different socials. And I've got different names on different platforms. So I'm Fosman on Instagram and Faraz Osman on Twitter.
And if you've enjoyed this episode, share she mean it by doing any or all of these things. You can tell your colleagues about the show on Twitter or LinkedIn. Text on LinkedIn is fine. Audio, if you really want to go for it, do that. You can also take out a riverside.fm trial using the code MEDIAPOD, or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/mediapod. You can follow us to hear the latest episodes when they drop in your podcast app of choice, or by going to podfollow.com/themediapodcast. My name's Matt Deegan. You can find my weekly newsletter about the audio industry and more at mattdeegan.com. The producer was Phoebe Adler-Ryan, with support from Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you next week.